From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. President Biden will likely give Russian President Vladimir Putin a list of demands when the two leaders meet in Geneva tomorrow. But the president has also said he does not want conflict. There's a lot to talk about. Ransomware attacks, election interference, a demand to withdraw from Ukraine. The BBC's Sarah Rainsford is in Geneva and joins us from outside of the meeting venue. And Sarah, President Biden is the one who called this meeting with Putin, so there's a lot of pressure on him for a positive outcome. But what does Putin stand to gain from this meeting?
Well, it's interesting. The fact that this was a summit suggested and requested by the American side is definitely something that the Kremlin has been underlining. Russia likes to be seen as an equal on the world stage. It likes to be taken seriously. And the fact that Joe Biden so early in his presidency has called for this meeting with President Putin is seen extremely positively by the Kremlin. They're certainly painting it as an expression and an understanding of equality, which I don't think the US president would actually agree with, of course. But in terms of what it can deliver, well, I think that's a fairly limited list of things. Vladimir Putin himself, when asked about it, said that they'll be talking about regional issues, they'll be talking about cybersecurity. But I think, as I say, for the Russians, the fact that this summit is happening and happening so early in Joe Biden's presidency is extremely significant.
Well, some NATO leaders have actually expressed concern that by meeting with Putin, Biden will actually be rewarding him. How do the concerns from other world leaders play into how Biden will navigate this meeting?
Well, I think he's got a difficult job because, of course, Vladimir Putin is a very experienced operator. And, of course, Joe Biden has said he's coming here saying that he will tell Putin what he wants Putin to know. And so he's obviously presenting himself as coming to talk tough to Russia. He's talking about going toe-to-toe with a man he's described and portrayed as an autocrat, coming here, of course, after meetings with America's Democratic allies. Russia, though, will not be rolling over and having its tummy tickled in any sense. Russia will certainly be looking, and Mr. Putin will be looking, to express forcefully Russia's point of view, and that is that you need to reckon with Russia. And whilst Joe Biden is talking about stability and predictability and blaming Russia for undermining that in the world, Russia sees everything quite in the opposite. One thing which is worth pointing out that is interesting, though, that neither side has agreed to a joint press conference after this meeting. So they will be talking to the press separately, which I think is critical because, of course, you'll remember it was the press conference between President Putin and President Trump previously, where Donald Trump was seen to, by the American side, to behave disastrously when he appeared to take President Putin's word that he hadn't meddled in U.S. politics over the evidence presented to President Trump by his own intelligence services.
Well, with all that you say in mind, what power does Biden actually have coming into this meeting? I mean, we know that the administration has already imposed several sanctions against Russia for election meddling and cyber attacks. But this puts Biden in an interesting position. As you say, Putin is also coming to the table with grievances as well.
Yeah, I think, you know, the way it's being presented in Moscow, which is, of course, where I'm based, it's being presented as that the men will not reach agreement, but they are hoping to reach an understanding. And, you know, Russia will want to present that as an understanding by America that Russia needs to be listened to. America will want to present it as Russia having agreed to stop its malign and meddling activity. You know, Russia, of course, doesn't admit to any of the things that it's accused of, from election meddling to any of the other long list of activities, including cyber attacks, attempted assassinations. Russia simply denies the accusations. So what can Joe Biden do to actually influence how Russia behaves? Well, certainly sanctions do have an effect on Russian policy. I think certainly when I talk to experts in Moscow about this, I think people understand that they don't believe that President Putin wants to increase the antagonism, increase the problems. It is a tough time in Russia as it is around the world. COVID has impacted Russia quite badly. The economy has been hit. I think the last thing that Russia needs, especially in an election year, which this is in Russia, is more antagonism with the United States. So I think it's about cooling it down, looking each other in the eye, trying to figure each other out, tiptoe around each other to some extent. But Russia will want to come out of this, certainly still looking strong, at least for the domestic audience.
Sarah, I want to ask you about another big topic during this summit, and that's the growing power of China. And there is nuance here because China is expanding military exercises with Russia. NATO has said it is very concerned about Russia's growing aggression. Can you say more about this focal point?
Well, when Mr. Putin was asked about China, he was clear to distinguish between Russia's relations with China and its relations with the United States and say that China is a friendly state. And certainly China will feature very much in terms of any further talks on arms control, nuclear arms control. Certainly the US and Russia do need to consider what happens after the latest current treaties expire. And there is discussion about whether China should be brought in to any treaties. Russia doesn't want that, but it is certainly, you know, a new factor in the equation. So, yeah, the relationship in that sense is increasingly complex too.
That's the BBC, Sarah Rainsford in Geneva. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Oh, I loved hearing those kids play. Well, ahead of the Putin meeting tomorrow, President Biden met with European leaders today and announced that the EU and U.S. have agreed to suspend billions of dollars in tariffs on aircraft and more and put a 17-year trade feud behind them. That feud involved countries subsidizing their own airline companies, Airbus in the EU, Boeing in the U.S., then slapping tariff levies on each other on things like U.S. whiskey and European wines. And the de-escalation comes as the U.S. and EU seem to notice that while they squabbled, China was working on passenger planes of its own. So let's bring in here now transportation analyst Seth Kaplan. And Seth, the Wall Street Journal calls this the longest and costliest trade fight in the history of the WTO. It dates back to 2004. Briefly, talk us through how it started.
Yeah, it's hard to overstate how costly it is. Boeing jets are the thing that the U.S. exports more in terms of value than anything else. Okay, so just billions and billions and billions of dollars. Sometimes you look at one airplane, that plane can be worth hundreds of millions of dollars. Nothing else like that that the U.S. exports. As you said, back in 2004, you know, one thing about the aerospace and airline industry, Robin, is everybody thinks everybody else is subsidized. And that's very much true here. This was the U.S. originally saying that Airbus was heavily subsidized. And there's no doubt that there's truth to the fact that European governments provided lots of seed money, billions and billions of dollars to get Airbus to where it was. The U.S. said, you know, Airbus was suddenly on an even footing with Boeing in a matter of not too long. Boeing had been in business nearly a century already, accusing the Europeans of illegally subsidizing Airbus. The Europeans later said, well, Boeing is subsidized too in the form of large orders from the U.S. government for military aircraft, for example, on a scale that it would never happen in Europe.
Well, then it escalated in 2019. It went well beyond airplanes, almost $12 billion worth of tariffs and levies on everything from wine to tractors. So why did the U.S. and EU decide to set aside these now? I mean, yes, they're looking at China, but man, this was such a battle.
It really was. And this happened quickly, caught a lot of people by surprise. And I think it comes down to what you said, just them deciding that there were bigger common enemies. If you think of other things we're hearing on the show today, right, about meeting with Putin, obviously concerns with China on trade. And this is the U.S. and EU saying we don't see eye to eye on everything yet, but better to sort of recognize those common enemies. Also, don't forget, Boeing and Airbus sort of have a powerful duopoly in the world. So as much as they compete against each other and they accuse each other of certain things, it's kind of this comfortable duopoly. And what they don't want to do is lose sight of the fact that they have far more to worry probably in terms of foreign competitors with far cheaper aircraft coming into the market and actually having some success than they do about each other. They've both been doing fine over the years being in that duopoly.
Well, but if subsidies are dropped, what would that mean for Airbus and Boeing, especially after, you know, this disastrous pandemic year?
Yeah, those two manufacturers have been through one of the worst periods here in the past year of their histories. But, you know, demand is rebounding now. You mentioned the Wall Street Journal. They reported, for example, just days ago that Boeing, all those 737 Maxes that nobody seemed to want for the past year, dating back, of course, to the issue with the plane itself. Suddenly there's demand for them, airlines snapping up those planes. And so these companies seem to be able to sustain themselves in a commercial environment. With Airbus, again, it goes back, if anything, more to the seed money sort of that got them to this position in the first place, and allegations by the U.S. that that continues. But a commercially successful company in its own regard.
Just briefly, we've got under a minute. What about China? Where are they on passenger planes?
So they have designed and built what's called the C919. So if you look at a 737, which a lot of people know what that looks like, or a competing A320, Airbus 320, China has a plane and it's flying already, not carrying passengers yet, but flying successfully in terms of test flights that they're selling. They've taken orders for 1,000 of them, so far mainly from Chinese companies. The concern is, what if it gets some success, some traction in the market, and China is able to begin underpricing Airbus and Boeing and selling them to, well, let's say U.S. and European airlines.
Okay, that'll be a whole other story. Seth Kaplan, Here & Now's transportation analyst. Thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
A slew of bipartisan antitrust bills introduced in Washington could change the way some of the biggest tech companies operate. For more, let's bring in Elizabeth Jawaskin. She's the Silicon Valley correspondent for The Washington Post. Hey, Elizabeth.
Hey, Tanya.
So folks actually might remember that there was this 16-month bipartisan investigation of tech companies. And these bills come out of that. They are recommendations made by a House antitrust panel. One of the biggest proposed changes is something that is pretty common in Silicon Valley, and that's the ability for big companies to acquire smaller, rising competitors. One of the bills would bar that practice. This is significant, isn't it?
I think it's very significant. It's one of the aspects of these bills that I would call a major blow to how big tech operates and does business. Google, Amazon, Facebook, and Apple have all had over 100 acquisitions in recent years. It's a large number of companies because of the Silicon Valley culture of startups. And in the case of Facebook, for example, they've really used the acquisitions to position themselves in the market in a dominant way. Facebook is not growing in the United States, the main Facebook, but they own WhatsApp and Instagram, which at the time were not dominant services, but are now almost as big, or in some ways getting as big as Facebook. And so if the big blue app that Mark Zuckerberg built in college, if that dies off one day or becomes a nothing burger, he still has these other services that allow him to own the biggest social network of the world, and ditto in some ways the other companies.
There's another element in this series of proposed legislation that would also make it easier for people to use different tech services together or move their data to a competitor. What kind of implications could this also have?
I consider that to be one of the other major blows to the big four. You know, it's known here in Silicon Valley as data interoperability. And it's just this idea, every consumer knows this, how hard it is to switch, but port your data over. Like, you can't take your data from Facebook and just drop it on a competitor service. We all know how hard it is to switch between Apple and Android. And this is already, by the way, well underway in Europe, which is to say that regulators are looking around the world are looking and saying, how can we promote competition? And one way they could do it is actually legally force and regulate the creation of code of technology, because it requires building all new platforms and services to basically build new protocols for the internet that would allow consumers to do something as simple as port over your data, because that makes it easier to leave a service when you're disappointed. One of the aspects of monopolies that's hard to prove in American law is, what's the harm to consumers? If these products are so great, everyone loves Google Maps, Gmail, what's the harm? And one of the ways that people might be able to express their dissatisfaction is by leaving the services. But there's these big walled gardens. It's very hard to do that. So it's hard to express dissatisfaction.
On Monday, Republican Senators Chuck Grassley and Mike Lee introduced a bill that would shift all antitrust enforcement from the FTC and the Federal Communications Commission to the Justice Department and allocate about $600 million to the DOJ's antitrust division. What does this indicate about Republican efforts with antitrust?
The big question is, there's these big spate of bills that are introduced by Democrats on Friday, and will Republicans support it? I mean, we look at what's happening with the rest of Biden's agenda right now in Congress. It's slowed down because there isn't always bipartisan support, and there's lots of debate. So in this case, what you see is Grassley and Mike Lee basically saying, we don't want a solution that's regulatory. We want a solution that is enforcement. It's around bringing cases in an emboldened Justice Department. And we're going to embolden that Justice Department, which is already, by the way, has major antitrust cases against Facebook and the other big four. So they've been really emboldened under the Trump administration. And Grassley and Lee are saying, yeah, let's embolden the lawyers to actually use the existing antitrust laws, but with more muscle behind it, to fight these cases. And what's interesting about these bills is they have a lot more bipartisan support right now than other initiatives. So right. They very well could pass. But when you look at them, you say, what the other lawmakers are saying is, no, we can't just wait for the lawyers and the Justice Department to come after these companies after they've already done harm. We need to try to create new structures in our society and our business that stop the companies from being so powerful and dominant and potentially harmful to consumers in the first place.
How are tech companies reacting, or how do you anticipate they will respond?
Just armies of lobbyists. These are the biggest lobbyists in Washington already, and that is going to grow. And now they actually have something concrete to fight against, as opposed to the last few years when we've seen these hearings and hearing after hearing and testifying and Zuckerberg testifying and lawmakers talking, saying they were going to do it. But now they have something to fight against and to erode. So I'm interested in seeing whether they're going to try to poison the well in some ways by not making the bill seem politically impalatable so that they don't get the bipartisan support, or in some ways weakening them, weakening those hurdles that will be created, for example, to buy new companies or to create products on their platforms. And so you can really see the companies trying to lobby to water it down. They're already very publicly saying that this would really hurt competition, and they're bringing in China. They're saying, well, look at the competition from China. Do we really want the next generation of great internet companies to not be American? And you're going to see a lot of that talk as well.
Elizabeth Dwoskin is a Silicon Valley correspondent for The Washington Post. As always, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Well, as our country gets ahead of coronavirus infections, it's now pledging to send hundreds of millions of vaccines to countries still struggling with high case rates and low vaccine supply. Shalina Chatlani of the Gulf States Newsroom talked with Indian immigrants in Mississippi who are concerned about their families and friends in their native country.
At her home in Madison, Mississippi, Amrit Sood opens up Facebook on her phone. She scrolls to a friend's post, one of many that have been flooding her social media.
She lives in Mississippi, and her aunt is in Delhi, and she needed a ventilator, and she's asking, do you know where to get it?
When the pandemic first broke out, India didn't experience a large wave of coronavirus cases, but now thousands of people are dying each day. Sood has lost nearly a dozen family members in India.
I can't keep up with the numbers, and it's hard to imagine if I go back.
Sood is from Delhi, but has lived in Mississippi for 45 years. She feels helpless being so far away. Meanwhile, vaccines where she lives go to waste. Mississippi, Louisiana, and Alabama have the lowest vaccination rates in the country. Last month, Mississippi's health officer Thomas Dobbs said the department is advising doctors to open up a package of vaccines, even if some of it may go to waste.
If you have somebody in front of you who needs a vaccine, go ahead and use what you got. But we know that we're at a point where there will be some wastage.
It is frustrating.
Sood got her vaccine in February, but in Mississippi, health officials say about 8,000 doses had been wasted as of June 9th. In Louisiana, roughly 13,000. Alabama reported just over 12,000 vaccines wasted.
I feel sad that in the third world, they wanted those shots and they cannot get it.
There's a shortage of everything from beds to oxygen in India. It sold most of the vaccines it produced to other countries. And as of June 10th, just 3% of its own population is fully vaccinated. President Biden recently announced that the U.S. would purchase 500 million vaccine doses to send abroad between this year and next. In the meantime, families here watch as friends and loved ones die from afar. Mississippi-based immigration lawyer Patricia Ice says this is something her clients deal with regularly.
I've had so many clients whose parents have died overseas and they couldn't leave because they didn't have papers. That's been going on since I started doing this work.
In her 2 decades of practice, ICE has seen clients from India, Yemen, Vietnam, Mexico, and other Latin American nations. Census data show there are over 430,000 foreign-born residents across the Gulf South. Some immigrants have jumped at getting the vaccine, but others are hesitant, especially in conservative places like Mississippi.
If the governor is telling you that it's really not that important to get the vaccine, some immigrants are listening to the government.
Her law firm has held events to ease concerns or help clients get shots.
And then you turn it on.
Some Indians in Mississippi are taking matters into their own hands to get supplies to people abroad who need them. Udaya Shivangi is a sleep medicine specialist in Ridgeland, Mississippi.
This is oxygen concentrator. When you plug it in, it uses the room air, so it makes the oxygen.
Shivangi is involved in the American Associations of the Physicians of Indian Origin. The group has been sending pulse monitoring devices and oxygen-producing machines to India.
We have already sent concentrators, 1,000 units, and we are sending next 1,000 units as soon as possible.
Other individuals are trying to send this equipment to their families, sorting through high international shipping costs and complicated procedures.
Somehow we need to help India first or any other country who may need in the future.
Some parts of the world have still only been able to vaccinate 1% of their populations. Shivangi, like other immigrants, say she's hopeful countries like the U.S. can lend the helping hand to these places that are most in need of a shot. For Here and Now, I'm Shalina Chetlani.
On NPR's Rough Translation,
there's just fewer people that know somebody that's in the military.
After 20 years of war, are civilians and military farther apart than ever?
They were asking me, do you want to hear this? Do you want to know us?
Listen to Homefront, the new season of Rough Translation.
An electric car maker, Lordstown Motors, is on the brink. The company's stock slipped nearly 20% after 2 top executives resigned on Monday. The company said last week it would go out of business after ethics concerns and ongoing safety problems with its electric pickup, the Endurance. Let's bring in Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Hey, Robin.
How are you?
I am well. So Lordstown Motors is a startup trying to build electric pickup trucks at a former GM assembly plant in Ohio. Can you tell us more about what led to the CEO and CFO to resign?
Well, they can't do it. It's electric. No, I just always wanted to say that. I think, Tanya, the obfuscation here is the alarming part. This is what the press release says. Quote, Lordstown Motors announces leadership transition. And there's quick mention of the CEO and CFO resigning, a quick thank you from a board member, and then talk of, quote, transition to the commercial stage of our business. Of course, this was simultaneous to an internal investigation that, quote, identified issues regarding the accuracy of certain statements regarding the company's pre-orders. And you put it all together, Tanya, and the company and the stock are hemorrhaging cred.
Okay, say more about this, because Lordstown was under investigation for misleading investors. They're accused of using fake orders to prop up the Endurance. Explain a little bit more what they're accused of.
Yeah, leading the inquisition is Hindenburg Research, which in the spring it issued a report titled The Lordstown Motors Mirage, Fake Orders, Undisclosed Production Hurdles, and a Prototype Inferno. And I'm quoting from the report, Lordstown with no revenue and no sellable product, they believe, has misled investors on both its demand and production capabilities. It alleges further that the company's orders are largely fictitious and used as a prop to raise capital and confer legitimacy. And as Lordstown has had to trim expectations and concede in this case reporting issues, these skeptical reports, they win more adherence. And so the stock is now at a third of where it traded in February.
Lordstown isn't the first electric car company to face these kinds of issues. There are 2 others as well, where their CEOs have recently resigned. Can you tell us more about these smaller electric car companies and what's getting them in trouble overall?
I think it's important to look at the broader market where hype has so far been rewarded in this very rich environment for tech and startups. Mm-hmm. Capital is cheap. It's omnipresent. Tanya, we've talked about individual investors with these meme stocks, AMC and GameStop. So the echo chamber for claims of, say, in this case, a great EV truck combined with the ease of listing shares, it gets you quite a platform. The problem is, at some point, the story runs into tangibility. Show me. Where's the vehicle? Where are the reviews, mm-hmm. tests, peer review? And the company can only punt so many times on deadlines and everything, and especially with short sellers and skeptics putting out reports and stoking the fears.
Right. The electric car company, electric car markets overall are getting more competitive. What does the landscape look like for this market?
Tesla remains the dominator, the bellwether, the trendsetter. It's worth just under $600 billion. It has wait lists for its vehicles, fanboys left and right, the lead in battery and software range. And so anyone, Lordstown included, who wants to make a run at the king here needs to be willing to sustain losses. A lot of trial and error. Mm-hmm. Tanya, this is something that vexes very well-capitalized automakers with decades and decades of experiences. So I think Lordstown is just a cautionary footnote at this point.
Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure, as always, thank you.
As always, thank you.
Lift every voice and sing till earth and heaven ring. Ring with a harmony of liberty.
Alicia Keys singing what's become known as the Black National Anthem, Lift Every Voice and Sing. Well, today, a new documentary will be released exploring the meaning of that song and the meaning of Juneteenth, the Black National Independence Day, June 19th, 1865, when word finally got to enslaved people in Texas, then the most remote region of the Confederacy, that a full 2 years earlier, the Emancipation Proclamation had freed them. Juneteenth is next Saturday. The film Juneteenth is a collaboration of 10 Black cultural institutions, including Milwaukee's America's Black Holocaust Museum, Seattle's Northwest African American Museum, and Cincinnati's National Underground Railroad Freedom Center, where we're going to linger a little today. That's Cincinnati's Gaieta African Drum and Dance Theater. They're featured in the film. Asia Harris is with the Cincinnati Center. Asia, we also hear in the film historian Carl Westmoreland say your center is on sacred ground. Remind us.
Yeah, so the Freedom Center is built in downtown Cincinnati in an area that we now call the Banks. There's restaurants, our stadiums for our national teams, but in the past it was known as Little Africa. And that's where free Black citizens formed their own community at the shores of the Ohio River. So the Ohio River was a literal physical divide between the slave state of Kentucky and the free state of Ohio. Ohio's economy was dependent upon the slave economy that supported the neighboring state of Kentucky. So there was a really heavy amount of conflict between pro-slavery empathizers and abolitionists, and Cincinnati citizens had to survive that violence that was sometimes supported by local politics, and the Black population was constantly in danger despite Ohio being free because state laws like the Fugitive Act of 1850 really threatened the life of anyone who was African American. Even though people settled here and lived their lives and started traditions here, they eventually had to flee because the amount of danger here in the state of Ohio.
Well, this is in the mid-1800s. You say the Fugitive Act, even though the state was free, they might have been considered fugitives?
So if you did not have what was called free papers, if you were stopped by someone who was in authority and you didn't have that, then you could be jailed or you could be stolen and kidnapped and taken back into slavery because you had no way to prove that you were not an enslaved person who was known as, yes, a fugitive.
Your name is the National Underground Railroad Freedom Center. Explain that part, Underground Railroad.
The Underground Railroad was a network of people and organizations that was formed to help people free themselves from bondage. So the Underground Railroad ran all the way from, Louisiana all the way up to Canada. And Ohio specifically was a very, you know, we could say there were many pro-slavery empathizers, but it was also a very busy place for the Underground Railroad. It was close to places like Ripley, Ohio, which was flooded with abolitionists. And, you know, John Parker, John Rankin, some of the more famed abolitionists, they lived there and they really grew strong networks that grew down to Cincinnati, through Kentucky, all the way through the South, and back up again to Canada.
Let's hear some of the spoken word portion of the Cincinnati portion of the new film, Juneteenth. First, we hear from Black historian Carl Westmoreland and then poet Gerard Lindsay.
If it were not for communities like Little Africa, a historic moment like Juneteenth may never have occurred. While enduring oppressive laws and violence, the families of Little Africa remained steadfast of being of service to countless freedom seekers escaping slavery.
10. It is more than just a symbol, it's a representation of greatness, perfection, and patience, overcoming anxiety and temptation to arrive at your destination. Everyone cannot give 10 because they do not have 10 to give.
Cincinnati poet Gerard Lindsay. Asia Harris, we also heard from historian Carl Westmoreland. Tell us more about him.
Mr. Westmoreland is our lead historian at the museum, and he actually was responsible for doing a major amount of the research that allowed us to have one of the most major artifacts of slavery in the country, which is a slave pen. So that slave pen actually came from Germantown, Kentucky, and they actually took the slave pen down and put it in its exact form back into the museum. People can see exactly what, you know, conditions these people were living in, and also to be able to reserve, you know, those buildings.
Oh, slave pen. Oof. We'll have pictures from you at herenow.org, but can you describe it?
Absolutely. So my grandmother was very heavily involved in the Freedom Center when I was a child. And when I was 12 years old, she took me to the slave pen in Kentucky on the land still. It was a two-floor building. And the reason that they were able to preserve it so well over time is because after the family who owned that slave pen sold all of their remaining enslaved people, they built a tobacco barn around it. So that was able to keep the building in a much better state than it would have been. Men were living on top, and young children and women were on the first floor. It still has some of its original shackles, the windows, the spacing for where the fireplace was, for where women would have cooked. So it's a very emotional space to be in, but also a very honorable space to see the conditions that our ancestors had to survive but have been able to thrive to now.
I was going to say, must be so chilling.
Yes. Yes, yes. And the perspective that I have of having been able to stand in it in its original state is a much more intensive experience for me that I'm really grateful for. And I think it influences, you know, what I can do in the museum today.
Yeah. I want to bring in now for just a couple minutes Tiffany Cooper. She's with the Cincinnati Symphony Orchestra. They collaborated with the center on the Cincinnati portion of the film Juneteenth. Tiffany, we also know that the film is an exploration of Lift Every Voice and Sing, as we said, written as a poem by NAACP leader James Weldon Johnson in the 1900s, then set to music, sung by a choir of 500 school children to celebrate Abraham Lincoln's birthday, also performed by your orchestra.
Yes. So Lift Every Voice and Sing, the Black National Anthem, is something that is really important to the African-American music repertoire. The Cincinnati Symphony Orchestra has an annual program every year recognizing the contributions of African-Americans to music. And we start our program off or end our program every year with this very important piece of music, this idea of Black liberation and the contributions that the Black community has made to this country.
Let's listen. Tiffany, we know the song was adopted by the NAACP, used as a rallying cry during the civil rights movement in the 50s and 60s. What does it mean to you?
It moves me personally to tears each time that I hear it played, whether it's sung or whether it has the orchestra backing it, because it really does speak to our experience and our desire to be fully embraced as Americans.
Yeah, it's a prayer. Asia Harris?
To me, I didn't grow up in a community where we really celebrated Juneteenth. So to be a part of a community now in a nation that seems to really have an awakening to recognize how significant this is to us just feels really special. For the museum, our contribution was based off the word perseverance. And that's one of our main pillars in the museum that we celebrate along with courage and freedom. And we just want to really highlight how we've persevered through music, through art, through spoken word, even through things like these artifacts that we have to understand the conditions and to really, you know, channel our ancestors and make them proud about the accomplishments we've been able to make despite, you know, the circumstances that we've been through.
Yeah. That's Asia Harris from the National Underground Railroad Freedom Center in Cincinnati. We also spoke to Tiffany Cooper from the Cincinnati Symphony Orchestra. Both of them worked on the new film Juneteenth. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I walked past a Victoria's Secret the other day, and there they were celebrating Pride Month, all sorts of little underwear and jammies in rainbow colors, and I thought, Gilbert Baker would love that. He's the activist, drag queen, and artist credited with designing the first rainbow flag back in 1978, stitching it together with volunteers for a parade in San Francisco, then encouraging his community to adopt it. Baker died in 2017, but not before he traveled the world, was invited to the Obama White House, promoting LGBTQ civil rights and the rainbow flag. Well, now a piece of his huge original flag, we'll have pictures at hereandnow.org, has just been found and returned to San Francisco. Charles Beal is the president of the Gilbert Baker Foundation, a friend of the late Gilbert Baker. He joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you.
And remind us, this parade in 1978 was one of pure joy in San Francisco. Harvey Milk had been elected San Francisco supervisor. He was in this gay pride parade. The flags were there. Remind us of the spirit behind the making of this flag.
At the time, the LGBTQ community really didn't have any good, hopeful, strong symbols. There were the intertwined sex symbols. There was the pink triangle that had been put on us by the Nazis. Some people tried to use the Greek lambda, but it was so obscure. And so there was actually a lot of discussion, not just in San Francisco, but across the country. Some of the people having that discussion were Harvey Milk. Our friend Cleve Jones was part of that discussion. And they reached out to Gilbert Baker because he was an artist and a drag queen and he sewed, and they wanted to know, you know, what kind of symbol he could come up with. And Gilbert actually was the one that said this new symbol should be a flag, which I think is often underreported. He had been so impressed with the bicentennial in 1976 and saw the power of the American flag. It was everywhere. And so he thought this new symbol should be a flag. And very soon afterwards, he had been out dancing at the Winterland Ballroom, and I think he was a little high at the time. And he just was so impressed by the diversity of the crowd that this idea of this rainbow of humanity hit him like a brick. And he said, our flag should be a rainbow.
It expressed such joy, such hope. But, you know, just a few months later, that same year, 1978, San Francisco Mayor George Moscone and the city supervisor Harvey Milk were assassinated. I remember that moment as just taking the air out of that joyous flag.
You know, when Harvey went down, when Harvey died, a lot of people sort of curled up into a ball and went into a very dark place. But there were people like Gilbert Baker and people like Cleve Jones that didn't stop. They kept working and they kept fighting. And the very next year, Gilbert went to the parade committee and said, let's make 400 rainbow flags and hang them on the light posts that run up and down Market Street.
It's astonishing to see how far it's gone. It hangs on, you know, U.S. Official buildings around the world. But the original flags, they hung, we understood, at City Hall. They fell into some sort of disrepair. He found them and took a huge piece, a huge swath of them, but then it ended up, for various reasons, stuffed away at his sister's house. What's it like? What's it like to have this original piece?
It's an emotional thing, I tell you. It's a very... I'm getting choked up now just thinking about, seeing that original cloth and everything it stands for.
What do you think about some of the variants? There's a flag that includes a black and brown stripe to represent communities of color. One includes pink and purple stripes to represent the trans community.
Well, Raman, I'm glad you asked that because, as president of the Gilbert Baker Foundation, I'm asked that question a lot. And our official response is fly the flag that speaks to your soul. There's room in the sky for all of them. And the original flag, was this symbol of hope. That's what Harvey Milk really had tasked Gilbert with, is that, that it need to give people hope because, for every kid who's in the closet, who wants to take that first step out of the closet, that flag is a beacon. And it's shining there saying, take that first step from darkness out into the light. And in Kenya, in the Kakuma refugee camp, 200 activists held their first pride parade. And they got about 1,500 feet, and then, 22 of them were arrested and beaten. And they were carrying three rainbow flags that were confiscated. And a young man in Iran was beheaded by his own family in an honor killing because he had the courage to come out of the closet. And his friends are racing down the street of Tehran, waving rainbow flags to protest his killing. They race in and out of buildings so they don't get caught. So that flag has power, it has meaning, and it gives people hope all around the globe. Something sometimes maybe in the United States we take for granted for because we see it everywhere, like you said, Victoria's Secret. But it's a really powerful symbol, and it means a lot to people.
Charles Beal, president of the Gilbert Baker Foundation, thank you so much, and happy Pride Month.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.